What are some harsh truths most people don't know or don't agree with you on about human nature?
I don't know that they know they disagree with me per se, but we make a bunch of assumptions about our motives that are relatively generous to ourselves. And we are also generous about those assumptions to other people around us. And most social science or human sciences tend to accept those assumptions about our motives for common behaviors. And I came to believe that they're wrong a lot. That is, we're just wrong about common motives, assumptions we have about our motives. And that's the basis for this book, The Elephant in the Brain, I'm holding up in front of you right now, if you're watching the video, but not the audio. As an economist, I entered economics, where we study various aspects of life, like schools and politics and medicine. And we tend to make the usual assumption that most people make about these areas. And then we run into a lot of troubles. There's a lot of obstacles in the way of our trying to figure out what's going on in these areas. And I spent many years learning our best thinking about these areas and, you know, trying to understand and come to terms with these puzzles that are in these areas. And then I finally started to consider the possibility that we're just wrong about our usual motive assumptions. And once you are willing to consider alternative motives, it turns out other motive assumptions can go a substantially long way into helping you explain these puzzles, and they are less puzzling, which is the evidence for these being our actual other motives. So that's a surprise to you, presumably, that you would be so wrong about your motives, and you might wonder, why would you be wrong? And so we can discuss that. But first, the challenge is to convince you you are actually wrong. And so our book, the first third of it roughly, goes over possible reasons why you might be wrong. That is, reasons why natural selection and evolution might have created you in ways that you're wrong, but that still doesn't tell you you're wrong. And so we have 10 chapters going over different areas of life. And in each area, we show you, okay, this is what you usually say your motive is. Here are some puzzles, some strange features about common behavior that doesn't fit so well with this explanation that you have. And here's this alternative motive story that makes more sense of your motives or your behavior. An alternative story of motives.
Yeah. And what's the most notable example out of the 10 where when you tell people this is actually the hidden motive, they're like, no, you're completely wrong. That can't be the
case. Well, the most surprising is medicine. Of course, if we start out with that, your listeners are going to be skeptical that I know anything at all here, because they'll think that's wrong too. Maybe we should start with something more obvious to them. But medicine, the usual story you have, everybody has, health economists have, is you can get sick. There are these specialists called doctors who can do things to make you well sometimes, but they're expensive. They're hard to judge their quality. And so we need insurance and regulation to help you get the best doctors and pay for it. That's our standard story about medicine. And then there's a number of strange features we learn when we study health economics or people's behavior around health and medicine that don't make as much sense with that story. So one of them is that we treat medicine as a luxury. As we get rich, we spend more and more money on medicine. We care a lot about keeping up with the Joneses in terms of a big effect on our medical spending is how much other people are spending on medicine. We are surprisingly uninterested in quality information about medicine that we get directly, although we're very eager to hear about consensus perceptions about quality. And we are very eager to regulate many aspects of medicine and health. We like to consume it collectively together, as opposed to letting people make their individual choices. And probably the most dramatic is that when we have randomized experiments where some people get a lot more medicine than other people, randomly, those people don't get healthier.
Wow.
So we by now have, you know, at least half a dozen randomized experiments on medicine. So the typical way to randomize is to assign some people a low price and other people a high price. And then the people with a high price, they don't buy as much. People with a low price, they buy a lot more. And then you look in these groups for differences. Usually mortality is the simplest thing to look for, but you can study many other measures of health. And then consistently, the people who got more medicine are actually not healthier.
Wow. That's crazy. And what, in these randomized studies, what medicine was specifically being, or was
it? It was all of medicine. We give you cheap, as much medicine, whatever kinds of medicine you want, we give it all to you cheap versus we restrict it. Mm. The most recent experiment of this form was in India, and it was hospital insurance. So some people got cheap hospital insurance where they could get access to hospitals much more cheaply, and other people had expensive hospital insurance. I think this was 80,000 people over 3 years, and no difference.
Wow. Wow. And does this mean medicine, say someone's ill, does that mean it's a lot of the time, if they have more medicine, it's not having a positive impact on their health? Is that the case for every single medicine that someone takes in?
So two things to note. This is about averages.
Yeah.
That is, some people could be helped, another could be hurt, and it could average out to zero. So it's not saying each effect is zero. It says the average effect is zero.
Yeah.
And it's only about the effect of the marginal medicine that some people got that other people didn't. There's some sort of things that everybody gets, regardless of which side of the treatment, this experiment they're on, then the experiment doesn't show the effect of that. It only shows the effect of the kinds that some people got that other people didn't.
Mm. Okay. Okay. And
it's still dramatic.
Yeah. And what's the, if that's the case, then what's the actual motive behind medicine being given? What's the behavior that's, how's that beneficial to us? What are some kind of evolutionary reasons?
Well, you mean, why do we bother with medicine then?
Yeah.
If it's not helping on the margin. So a common motive that people would say, sometimes somewhat cynically or observing other people, is that we use medicine to show that we care about each other.
Mm.
So for example, when people are sick, other people visit them in the hospital, if somebody's living nearby, you might bring them dinner or food, right? We are often eager to show that we care about associates who are sick. And one of the ways we show about associates who are sick, for example, we often pressure them to go to the doctor in the first place in order to check out some symptoms. If something's going wrong, we're very concerned about them and wanting to make sure they go get proper care. And then if they're family members or children even, we might make sure we pay for their care. And we like to work for companies that will pay for our health care, because that makes us feel more that they care about us. We like our nations even to pay for our health care as a way to feel solidarity and connection to our nation. So people are quite often in the habit of using care as a way, healthcare, medicine, as a way to show you care about people and a way to judge who cares about you.
Mm-hmm.
So an analogy might be Valentine's chocolates. So as you know, we have a tradition wherein on Valentine's, if there's someone you care about, you might give them some chocolates to show them you care about them on Valentine's. And they will be not only enjoying the chocolate, but enjoying the fact that you took the effort to show that you cared about them.
Mm.
Now, if you think about the quality of Valentine's chocolates, when you're giving the chocolates, you actually don't care that much about what you privately think about the quality. You care about giving chocolates that are seen or perceived to be high quality, and they actually don't care so much about what they privately think is quality. They care about what other people would say is the quality. So you're pressured to give quality of chocolate for Valentine that's perceived widely to be good. And it doesn't that much matter what each of you privately thinks.
Yeah.
That's the nature of a gift.
Yeah.
And that's related to, in medicine, we aren't actually very interested in private signals about the quality of medicine, although we are very interested in wide perceptions about the quality of medicine.
Mm.
Go ahead.
And from a selfish perspective, when we're giving people, advising people to go to the doctors or advising them to take medicine when they're sick, how does that circle back and benefit us in the long run in terms of an evolutionary standpoint?
Well, people are very social. and we form groups and we become dependent on our associates, and we want to be picky about our associates. So we care that our associates are smart and capable, et cetera, but we also care if they're loyal. Mm. We're worried that they may betray us in important situations. I mean, so this is one of the reasons why I say at the office, you might just go chat with people, you know, every morning when you come in, just to go around and show everybody that, you know, you care about them and you're still friends with them, et cetera. But when we are sick and vulnerable, these signals of care are just much more potent and important because, in fact, if somebody was going to betray you, this is the perfect time to do it.
Yeah, true.
So
yeah.
Our ancestors, when they got sick, you know, basically our ancestors had to get up and move every once in a while off to a new place a couple times a year. And, you know, if you're sick and can't be moved or need to be carried, or people need to come and bring you food, if they were going to betray you, this is the perfect time to do it, right? Because they can just head off. They'd not take care of you, just disappear from your view. And you know, you're weak and you can't retaliate. Then this is obviously the time to do it. So when we're vulnerable, we especially want signals of loyalty, because in fact, if they were disloyal or tempted to be disloyal, this would be the perfect time. So the fact that they are not disloyal at the perfect time to be disloyal is a strong signal. Of course, we don't want to die.
Mm.
So even if medicine doesn't help, just bringing us food, protecting us from predators, keeping us warm, out of the rain, those are all helpful things in keeping us from dying. So we are very appreciative of our associates helping us out when we really need it.
Mm. And are we hoping they reciprocate when we're in a similar situation in the future? Say we become ill, we're hoping because we cared for them, they'll do the same for us.
Right. You're bonded together. You believe that you care about each other. You will sacrifice and help each other. That's a nice thing to have as a social creature. Right? Humans were not solitary creatures like a lion or, you know, or leopard or something. They were in large social groups and they evolved to need those social groups. So if a group kicks you out, nobody else will take you in. You're in deep trouble.
Mm. And you've spoken about the difference between gatherers and the more like agricultural and farmer societies. And how large were the groups of societies that were gatherers? How big were the groups? And when did religion come into play?
Okay, so we're moving a bit away from the hidden motives topic here, just to the history of, humanity and growing. Humans lived in small forager groups of, say, 20 to 50 humans for maybe 1 million years or 2 million years. Those are larger groups than most other primates have. So humans were pioneering managing larger groups. Typically, smaller primate groups, if they grew larger, they would fracture. They would have conflicts within them and they just couldn't stay together. So humans were unusually able to keep larger groups together, but they were groups of, say, 20 to 50. And then in their lifetime, they might meet, you know, 3 to 5 other such groups for a total of, you know, meeting 150 people in their lifetime. That was the world of foragers. And so they knew pretty much everybody pretty well. And then with the rise of farming, roughly 10, 20,000 years ago, humans stopped rotating around and traveling and stayed in one place and started collecting more stuff there because they could. And then they were in sort of groups of maybe 1,000 associates in the nearby area who could all meet each other and interact and trade and go to war. And religion is something that's gone through several stages. Now, foragers, it seems, had spirituality and sacred things. But what we might call religion is a more modern thing. And again, there are several stages, apparently, that religion has gone through. So say Christianity was a new novel kind of religion that showed up in what we call the Axial Age, where a number of other similar sorts of religions appeared around the world. Previous religions were more like religions than spirituality, but they were still substantially different. They, for example, didn't care as much about what you believed. They care about what you did.
Hmm.
A while back, there was an era where most societies around the world did a lot of human sacrifice.
Wow.
And that was a part of their, I guess you'd call them, religious world. We don't understand that very much now, but religion has gone through many things. And even today, you might say religion has changed a bit in the last century in terms of what we call religion or what fills that role in our lives.
Yeah. And I'm pretty sure religion was an example in The Elephant in the Mind. What's the hidden motive behind religion that you've uncovered?
So the usual story about religion that people will give for their religious affiliation is that they believe different things. There's this scriptures, religious texts, you know, handed down stories, and they believe these stories and they believe these texts. And therefore that makes them act differently. And then they have different lives and behaviors because of their beliefs. That's our usual story about religion. Now, sociologists and other social science for a long time has said that the function of religion seems to be to bind groups together so that they can be loyal to each other and rely on each other. And that's the actual function of religion. And that does seem plausible. And then the beliefs are more a way to get them to bind together. They believe what it takes to signal to each other that they're very concerned and very attached to each other. Now, this need to bind together in groups makes sense. The need to have something that they share that binds them together, that makes them different from other people, makes sense. But again, it's noteworthy that this isn't what people are saying in their heads. They're not saying, I need a group. Here's some people. Let's be a group together. Let's do some things that show that we care about each other. That's not how they see themselves. They see themselves as believing sacred things. And then those sacred beliefs are, and you know, the sacred things they are connecting to through their beliefs and actions are the things that they share and bind them together. And it's because those sacred things really exist and really are important that that's why they need to stick with these associates who are together with them seeing the sacred thing.
And was this form of binding people together more important the more the population in the world and increased and the more small tribes became entire countries? Was religion a good way to keep large amounts of people in large amounts of areas in more social cohesion?
Well, so there's this, I'm not very sure about this, but there's a standard story that human have been forming larger and larger social groups for a long time. So again, we started out with a size of 1,000, and now maybe the whole world is a large social group at the level of 8 billion. So over time, we've been forming larger and larger social groups. And then we've had slowly over time, different mechanisms by which we bind those groups together, govern them, distinguish them from outsiders. There's been many, many orders of magnitude. You see, we've moved through in the size of these groups, and over time, we've adopted different methods. So a standard story for, say, about the rise of Christianity and religions at the time was that the previous religions were more tied to local ethnic groups and therefore could only bind together groups of that size. So each place had its own gods that were from that place and from those people, etc. And then to bind together larger groups, they needed to have a kind of sacred that was less tied to their ethnic group and their particular history. And Christianity and the other major world religions that arose at the time were those sorts of religions that helped to bind together larger groups.
And do you think there's a hidden motive behind science? Is science kind of a way of binding people together? Have you done any research on that?
So our book has 10 areas of life where for each area, we tell you this is the usual story and here's an alternative story we think makes more sense. But only 10 areas of life. There could be another, 50 areas of life in principle that we could have gone through with this sort of analysis. We didn't. And you might imagine we could do a sequel on doing that. But one of the things we might have hoped is somebody else would be inspired by our book to try to work on these other areas. And we've seen very little of that, which is surprising. That is, most readers, we've got relatively few people who disagree with our book, surprisingly, maybe on medicine or something. But we basically say, look, there's 10 chapters. If you believe us about 7 or 8 of them, you're on board. We don't need to convince you about all of them. We just need to convince you this is going on a lot, okay? And most people are convinced of that. Yes, 7 or 8 of these areas yes, we have hidden motives. We don't get it. And we have these other motives. Now, you might think that would inspire people to go find more hidden motives elsewhere in the world. And yet all these people are convinced by our book. They believe it. They're not very interested in going and finding more hidden motives. That says something about how eager we are to learn about hidden motives. It seems not so eager. That's all a prelude to saying, you know, you and I can now talk about science and we can think about it, but I haven't gone through and done all the work. But you might think this is a good test to just take something and try to work it through. So from the method that we use in the other chapters, the first task is to find puzzles. First, what is the usual story? Why do we get together to do science? We need a story about that. Then we want to ask, what are some puzzles with respect to the story? Okay, so the usual story certainly is insight. We want to have an insightful, true, accurate description of the world that we can use as the basis for satisfying our curiosity, practical application, et cetera. That would be the story, right? And now we'll look for puzzles, things that don't quite fit that story. And we can say, for example, in academia, when people write a paper and they submit it to a journal for publication, and the referees try to evaluate that paper, they don't usually look for insight. They don't ask how important is this result or how much impact will it have or, you know, how valuable could it be to the world. That's just usually not considered in evaluating a paper. What are they considering? Well, it's usually about impressiveness and technique and sort of dotting all the I's, sort of any possible way something could be wrong or not quite as rigorous, is not as careful. They want to find those and point them out and make sure you get all that stuff right. And they'll do that on something that's important or unimportant. That's a bit puzzling. What's another puzzle? Another puzzle is that if you think about all the important topics out there and you just pick a topic and you say, who's studying this? Well, it usually turns out that their academics are in clumps and none of those clumps are that close to the topic you mentioned. So academics are in these clumps where inside the clump, they're really focused on the topics in that clump and they all talk to each other a lot about it and they just put a lot of energy into it. And then between the clumps are topics nearly as important as the topics in the clumps, but hardly anybody's touching them. So if our goal was insight, why would we clump so much? Why do we neglect the topics between the clumps? That's a puzzle, right? So you see the game now. Find puzzles, find phenomena that aren't that well explained or fit that well with the theory you had, as we're just trying to collect insight. So any other puzzles come to your mind? Any other like conflicts between, you know, what we say and what we do?
Well, one that comes to my mind, but it might not actually be a puzzle, just sparked my mind. Going out at a young age, going to nightclubs, people often are just there like, oh, I want to have a good time. I want to be with my friends.
Well, that's not a puzzle with science, is it though?
No. I thought you were asking about
we can explain science.
Oh, okay. I didn't know about science. I was going to use going out as an example. But I always think the hidden motive is people often are going to at least try and find a mate or trying to find someone to get with,
and
but they don't always explain
quite so
that.
Hidden. Yes.
Yeah. It's not always hidden, but maybe the start of the
night. They aren't willing to be that forward about it.
Yeah. Wait, hold that thought. I'm genuinely so grateful that you've stuck around with us to listen to these fascinating insights from the guest so far. If this episode has given you one piece of knowledge which has helped you understand yourself and the world a little bit better than before, the absolute best way to support us is to pay it forward and hit the share button right now. Don't let this knowledge stay hidden. Please send it to one person who will benefit from this episode. Thank you so much. Let's dive back into the rest of the episode.
Yes.
Yeah. But I can't think of any of science.
Right. Well, anyway, we could find more for science, or I could say, well, these two puzzles we described here, I think are better explained by saying that science is a place where people are credentialed as being impressive. And the most local function science forms is to, first of all, you know, professors and other researchers are credentialed as impressive. They're allowed to publish and they're allowed to have these jobs. And then reporters will interview them. But then also they get to teach our children. If we want our children to be impressive, we trust them to teach them and to gain associations with them, because our children will gain prestige by association with these prestigious scientists. So that looks more like the local function of science and academia in people's lives is to be a source of credentialed impressiveness.
Yeah.
And the insight is more of a side effect. That is, we're not that interested in the insight if it doesn't come with this credentialed impressiveness. It needs to be a person who's credentialed as having been impressive in somehow producing insight. But they don't actually have to be that insightful. They just have to be impressive. They have to have a command of, you know, difficult tools and difficult concepts and be able to apply them fluidly and impressively and then be accepted as such by their associates. That's impressive. And that's mainly what we seem to want.
Yeah. So is it authority over new insights?
Well, the insights are more of a side effect. Now, still, if you want to go into an area of life where you can find the highest chance of collecting general insights about the world, academia is actually one of the best places to be. And that's why I'm here. But the world I'm in is not organized to maximally produce insights. That's not what it's focused on. It's focused on credentialing impressiveness.
And speaking of academia, you also wrote about education. So what are the hidden motives behind education that most people aren't aware of or don't want to admit?
That's right. So the standard story about education is that we are learning useful stuff that will help us on our jobs or our lives or as citizens. That's the usual story of education. Here you are, an ignorant youth. You go to school, you come out no longer ignorant, and with skills and knowledge that will be useful to your future life. That's the story of education, right? And presumably, if you've been around education all in your life, you can start to notice some of the puzzles where, in fact, most of the things you learn in school aren't actually very useful. Most of the things you learn in school, you don't remember anymore. But nevertheless, people who go to school get more pay in their jobs. They get more respect. That's a bit puzzling. Why spend all this time in school if the stuff you learn there isn't actually very useful and you don't actually remember much of it? Well, if people are paying more for people who come out of school, they must be more impressive and more impressive in a way that would make you want to hire them. So they are shown to have features that are desirable in employees. They're smart, conscientious, conformist. They've learned modern workplace practices. You can give them instructions and go away for a week and see them still working on it. Those are valuable features that people learn from school, or they are selected from school. That is, it might be a school doesn't actually produce any of these features. It just selects them. Your ability to survive through school and prosper there shows that you have these good features. Doesn't mean the school gave you those features. It means you have them, which is enough.
So it could be more of a selection process than actually us being taught it. It's more maybe innate, those skills.
Right. But it's, you know, but if that's the truth, you think this is a very expensive selection process. Couldn't we do something more faster, cheaper, more useful as a selection process?
And that's what would your selection process be that is cheaper?
Well, the obvious alternative would be some sort of internships or youthful jobs wherein you also display these capabilities, but then we don't waste your time as much. We actually get something out of you and you actually learn useful skills for later in life. And then the puzzle is, why aren't younger internships and jobs actually displacing high school and college as a way to help young people find their way in the world? And my best theory of that, which I'm not very sure of, is just the idea that we are not very good at coordinating the internships. So if you go to University of Cincinnati and get a bachelor's in civil engineering and get a B+ grade there, people who've never heard of or don't know much about University of Cincinnati or their program still kind of think they know what that means. And what sort of jobs you might be suitable for and what sort of, you know, training they would want to put you through. And job internships just don't have that predictability. People, you could have worked for Google for 3 years and, you know, your manager could write a letter for you, but we'd look at that and go, what does that mean? We don't know how to slot you. What sort of category of comparable people that we should think you're like. And that means the internship is less valuable to the student than the college degree because they can more be predicted. So my theory then is it's a failure of firms to coordinate on a shared way to evaluate and describe their internships and their junior workers, which makes college beat them out in that. So if only some enough large enough consortium of firms could make a set of young jobs be standardized enough and comparable enough, then it might have a shot. But at the moment, that's not how it's going.
What about if universities had separate internship programs, would there still be a coordination problem?
Well, different universities have different degrees and different qualities, but somehow the world of universities has coordinated enough to make a shared ranking of schools and a shared categorization of departments so that people can again know what it means to have a civil engineering degree and a grade of B plus. Right.
Yeah.
And that's the key thing is having these comparable units. Now, recently I realized another big effect of school is creating the world of youth movements. So before high school, say, people at high school age would go off into the workplace. And as young, you know, 14-year-old boys or girls, they would be very eager to be accepted by the adults around them as participants in their work world. So they want to act like adults, mix with adults, you know, acquire the tastes and habits of adults. They would be very eager to be treated as adults because they are fearful that other people will look down on them and disrespect them because they are, in fact, just 14-year-old kids. But they have some virtues that others don't, maybe more energy, stamina, things like that. And they will find a place in that world and be respected enough to participate. And that means they are immediately pulled into an adult culture and an adult's world. Once we have high school and then college, we put all these young people together and now they form their own teenage culture and teenage community, which created the whole world of teenage culture, which didn't exist before then. And this happened in the late 1800s, is the rise of high school and then college, which is more recent than most people realize. And now, with all these young people together, they formed not only their own separate culture, but also were very eager to anticipate and influence larger cultural trends. So I just read this book called World of Yesterday by Zweig about his youth when he was in the around 1900 as a teenager, or in the late, very late 1890s. And he was in Vienna and his friends and he were very strongly, you know, eager to participate in the culture of Vienna. And they went to plays and they went to concerts and they had were fans of different people. And then they tried to write their own stuff and make their own stuff. And they helped influence the changes in culture at the time because young people have a strong advantage in coordinating together to agree on a cultural trend that they want to try and push and then put a lot of energy into it. And in fact, since then, most cultural changes in the world have been driven by youth movements.
Yeah. Yeah.
To a surprising degree. I mean, young people hardly know anything. Like, let's just be frank about that. But
the whole point
they have a lot of energy and passion and a lot of potential. And they throw all that into each new youth movement. And that actually moves the world. So I actually did a survey where I asked ChatGPT, find me 100 examples in the last few centuries where young people and old people had some conflict about something. And in the end, who won?
Was it the young people?
96 out of the 100 times the young people won.
Wow.
One out of the 100 times the old people won. And the other three were ties. That was the scoring. So youth movements just consistently win. And so they are just plausibly a main driving force of cultural change over the last century or century and a half. And culture has been changing a lot over the last century or so. And that's a big fact about the modern world. School made youth movements. Youth culture made youth movements.
Do you think that's a net benefit for society, or neutral, or net negative?
I actually, unfortunately, think it's a net negative. So,
really?
So the key question in culture is whether culture is adaptive. So human superpower is cultural evolution. That's what made us different from all the other animals. And cultural evolution is just a simple process of natural selection where different practices are copied and spread. And then the things that copy them and use them either succeed and multiply or shrink and die. That's cultural evolution. So in the past, culture was very conservative and reluctant to change because core elements of culture had been, you know, the product of a million years of selection. They were precious and people were reluctant to risk changing them. And then a century and a half ago, all of a sudden, our culture decided, no, we want to change stuff all the time. Now, our world was changing fast, right? So if, in fact, we could make a process whereby we see how the world is changing and we change our culture to anticipate and adapt to those changes, that would be good because part of what cultural evolution needs to do is not just preserve stuff that we found out before, but to adapt to changes as they appear. So there was a need for a process of changing culture to adapt to changing conditions. And often youth movements did see themselves as a group trying to adapt culture to some, what they saw as a changing condition, but usually the condition they saw themselves as adapting to was some sort of moral framework or moral mood that they thought was more appropriate to the world they saw around them, which unfortunately just doesn't seem to have much to do with adaptive selection pressures. The youth movements, the thing they're looking at tends to be some internal vision or feeling of what's appropriate, what fits, what makes sense, what seems right to them. That's the driving source of youth movement changes. And that just doesn't seem to be drawing from adaptiveness. Adaptiveness, you know, in human history has just been this process by which some things win and some things lose as they compete. And it doesn't seem like the changes we've been making over the last century because of youth movements have been adaptive changes, unfortunately.
And how would we define adaptive versus maladaptive changes in this context? How would you define that?
Well, it's a biological concept. It's just the biological concept. As you know, natural selection is about selecting for adaptive things. Adaptive means just whatever wins in the long run in selection. That is, whatever features would in fact make something more likely to win out in selection contests. So obviously, technologies can make you adaptive if they make you more capable and powerful. But then other attitudes and values can also be adaptive. That is a way that which, say, you can suppress crime. You can help people be more cooperative. Those can be adaptive. Induce people to have and raise children, to be loyal to each other. You know, all of those are adaptive features, and it's about sort of the relative weighting of them. But unfortunately, most of these cultural changes have not been plausibly the sort of things that produce these features.
And what are some examples of the cultural changes? Would it include stuff like communism and atheism?
Well,
and
well, for example, one of the most clearly maladaptive features that you can identify in cultures today is low fertility. That just doesn't make sense for a biological species in times of plenty and peace and health to be not having very many children. That's maladaptive. If we ask, why are we having low fertility, you can identify roughly half a dozen cultural trends that have been contributing to low fertility. More years of education, norms changing from, cornerstone marriage to capstone marriage. Then there's a separation of grandparents and they don't live as close and they are not as involved in life, a less arranged marriage.
Birth control.
Birth control isn't so much a culture, but, but it's still, it can contribute. That is a cultural acceptance or embracement of it, but it's less important than I think many people think. It's more that people today don't want to have children, or basically once they pair up and get married, they're ready to have children, but they have different standards about who they should marry and when they should marry. And that's delaying and reducing fertility. But the point is, each of these is a cultural trend And many of them have been cultural trends caused by our large cultural changes over the last century, most of which have been driven by youth movement. So, you know, that's more concrete evidence that we are just suffering from maladaptive culture. And I fear basically this means that our civilization will in fact collapse.
Really?
Like the Roman Empire did. They fall and decline.
Wow.
And to be replaced by some other civilization a few centuries later. Mm-hmm. Plausibly by, say, the Amish and Haredim, who have been doubling every 20 years for a century in their insular, fertile religious subcultures. So,
What are they? What groups are they? Did you just
mention? Amish, say, like the Mennonites and Amish, they're basically some Christian groups that are very insular. That is, they have their separate religious communities of roughly 50 to 100 people. Basically, when they reach 100, they split into two groups of 50. They do that roughly every 20 years because they have been doubling every 20 years for a century. They're very religious, very fertile. Up until recently, they were farmers largely. The last generation, they've switched to being rural small business people. And if you double every 20 years, that's how the Christians took over the Roman Empire.
Mm.
They just doubled every 20 years for three centuries, and that'll do it.
That could happen again then, round
yes,
two.
Yes, indeed. Wow. And wow. So humanity isn't at risk of going extinct, but we're at risk of the world losing many of the things we value about our shared civilization.
Mm.
I value, for example, free inquiry a lot. The Amish and Haredim don't seem as particularly into free inquiry.
Mm.
And just like the Christians rejected many aspects of the Roman Empire once they finally took over, things they didn't like and things that were gone by the time things had collapsed. You know, as we collapse in scale, we will just lose many technologies and abilities to coordinate and specialize because we can't support that with a smaller scale.
Mm.
And world population will probably peak in roughly three decades.
Really? Wow. And do you not think there'll be any pressure in the next few decades for that to try and be reversed? Or do you think it'll be too late by then, even if that's the case?
Well, if people wanted to change culture to fix these problems, they could. The question is whether they will want to. I mean, the key problem is that culture is the source of our desires for changing culture.
Mm.
That is, culture tells us what we want and what we like and what we respect. And if culture tells us to like and want and respect things that are maladaptive, we still do. The only, you know, it would be some arising of some subgroup who had different values and different norms and them winning somehow that would cause the rest. So, I mean, there is an effect of the world whereby when there are winners and losers, we tend to want to copy the winners.
Right? Yeah.
So that's one of the reasons the West has won over the last century or so. The West seemed to be just clearly winning. And the rest of the world said, we need to be winners, so let's copy the West and be like the West. Now, the West is rich and declining, but we're still the richest. And so the question is, will other people look at us and go, you're declining. We don't want to copy you anymore. Let's find somebody who's winning and copy them. But I'm not sure that merely because our population is declining, we will be seen as losers. We're still going to be the rich ones, the source of most culture, the source of innovation. And then there'd have to be some deviant culture that's actually doing different and winning. So I think it'll be a while before, say, the Amish and Haredim seem impressive enough for people to want to copy them. Sure, they're growing, but you go visit their farms or whatever and go, how impressive is that? Yeah, I don't see any big, impressive buildings or machines or great concerts or whatever. People aren't that impressed by them. They're just winning. So a big element of culture is what counts as status. What are the markers of status? And one of the ways culture can be wrong is if the status markers go wrong, then the whole culture goes wrong just pursuing the wrong sort of status. And that's plausibly part of how we're going wrong. Say education counts a lot for status in our world. And even if it's causing lower fertility and actually not helping you as much on your job as you think, it's very much high status and people are just still eager to pursue high status education.
Mm. And let's talk about EMS, brain emulations. Could that be a way to counteract this? Am I thinking correctly? If it was somehow created in the next few decades or the next century?
So brain emulations is the topic of my other book, The Age of M, that I'm holding up now. It's a kind of AI that's easier to analyze. So I did an analysis of what happens if we had human level intelligence in machines in a particular form that's easier to analyze. And then I work through how that whole world changes. So any form of human level AI will definitely produce stronger selection pressures. Unless we regulate the hell out of it, they will just be more Malthusian and compete with each other. And that's good from the point of view of cultural evolution, stronger selection pressures. It's just not clear it's enough. Because one of the other problems we have is way too little cultural variety because of having a world monoculture. And unfortunately, any form of AI also runs the risk of inheriting a world monoculture.
Yeah.
And so it's not clear that they will be able to separate from that. They would have a different sort of education. So maybe it's less clear that they would have youth movement culture change due to education. But unfortunately, the problem is there's like four key parameters of cultural evolution process, and all of them have gone badly over the last few centuries. And questions whether just making one of them better is enough. It's not clear that it is.
Yeah.
But it plausibly would help. It's just not clear it helps enough.
Yeah. And if someone doesn't actually know what brain emulation is, can we go back and quickly define that for them?
So, you on your head, I have a brain. So we have these brains, and these brains have a computer inside that's actually human level intelligence computer. It's running on an unusual kind of hardware compared to our computers. And the software is encoded in all the complicated connections in that brain that we don't understand. But if we could just scan a brain at fine level and just see where all the cells are connected to what of what type, we plausibly could make a emulation of that whole brain in a computer. It would just copy the connections between things, the types of connections, and the kinds of processing that happens in each cell and connection. And if you could scan in enough detail and get a good enough model of each of those parts, you could just make a whole computer that emulated, i.e. copied the behavior of the human that you had scanned. That emulation is economically valuable because the original human is economically valuable. So if you could hook an ARC with artificial eyes, ears, hands, and mouth, you could ask it to do things. It might do things. You could hire it for a job. And if it were cheaper than the humans, then it could do a lot of those jobs. And a key feature is you can just make copies of them as easily as making a copy of a computer file. The population of brain emulations could expand very quickly, which is why wages would fall to Malthusian levels, which is why they would introduce a more competitive world.
Yeah. And you've kind of tried to run through what it might look like, what the world might look like if this was possible. What are some of the major changes of the world, of society, if brain emulations become possible? How does it change the world?
So it's, to one approximation, it's the way all human-level AI would change the world.
Yeah.
And then there are some differences for this kind of AI versus other kinds of AI. So all AI at human level would change the world by basically replacing human workers with AI workers. And that has obviously a number of huge effects. One is most people lose their jobs and they need some other source of income. Secondly, human work is no longer the center of the world. It's no longer driving change and where all the action is. The action is in the AI workers. Third, the economy would grow much faster because at the moment, a limiting factor in growing the economy is growing humans, but you can just grow the number of AIs much faster than you can grow the number of humans. So plausibly the economy could double, say, every month instead of every 15 years, 20 years as it does now. And wealth, if you own any wealth, that would also grow at the rate the economy does. So if you have any sort of wealth, real estate, stocks, whatever, it could double every month like the economy does. So humans who have any small amount of wealth could quickly have a lot of it. Humans who don't have any wealth, unfortunately, doubling nothing gives you nothing. So it's important before this transition that humans acquire some sort of asset that would allow them to live in this new world, either an asset, a wealth they could grow, or an insurance contract of some sort that would pay out before this sort of change. Obviously, this world would become big fast.
Yeah.
Doubling every month. And then maybe after a year or two of that, something else would happen, because that would be, as far as we might want to extrapolate by comparison with previous eras, but it would clearly change the world immensely to have a world full of AIs that are productive and doing stuff. Mm-hmm. Now, brain emulation is an unusually human-like kind of AI, and therefore we can say more about that world because the brain emulations feel and think, and from their own point of view, they are humans. Mm. They're in this artificial computer. So they would plausibly love and form families and have motivations like humans do. And so we can then work through more about how their world is like and how it plays out. For example, they probably need to retire after maybe a subjective century or so. They could still live forever in retirement, but they probably wouldn't be competitive with younger versions after that duration. And the world would continue to get refreshed by young emulation copies who then learn careers and life in the new world. The world would probably concentrate into a small number of dense cities and be much less spread out across the world than it is now, because emulations can just get closer to each other and get more benefits from that than humans can. So they'd be less interested in large parts of the earth, even less interested in space, because the time scales just increase. In fact, the typical emulation probably runs at roughly 1,000 times human speed. So that means the economy doubles every month, but subjectively, that's maybe a century. Mm. So from their subjective point of view, the world changes slower than our world changes for us, even though objectively the world is changing much faster. Those are some of the basic features you could learn about that world. Mm. Learn a lot more, of course, in the Age of M book.
Yeah, of course. And why do they run so much faster? Is it just because they're a computer?
Computers can run at different speeds. And then the question is, what's the optimal speed? So there's a trade-off in speed. So basically, you run a computer twice as fast, it's going to cost twice as much. So you better be getting twice as much value from it. But there's two kind of trade-offs here. One is, if the economy is doubling every month, you want to fit a whole career into that month.
Yeah.
Because by the end of the career, you need to change things anyway. So the scale at which the economy doubles is roughly the scale at which everything changes a lot. And so your skills become obsolete on that sort of scale. So you want your career to be less than that scale. Otherwise, you know, the world's going to change really fast after you learn how to do a job, and most of your training is kind of wasted.
Mm.
So that means you want to be going at least 1,000 times faster than us. But the thing that means you don't want to be much more than 1,000 times faster is, if you're crammed all together in a city of, say, a few tens of kilometers wide, then if you run much faster than 1,000 times human speed, you'll start to notice delays when you interact with other creatures in the same city. Just the speed of light delays within the city will mean that if we're together in a virtual room, you'll notice I'm a little slow and reacting to you because I'm in fact on the other side of the city. So to make everybody in a city not really care who's where in the city and have fluent interactions with them, then they need to run not much more than 1,000 times human speed. So that means roughly 1,000 times human speed.
Mm. And why would they not want to go to space? Is it because it's better if they're close together?
Right. The delay to space becomes even more, right? If it's a noticeable delay, if I'm 100 kilometers away, you know, if I'm at Mars, it's a crazy long delay. And even just taking a month to get to Mars, the investment opportunity cost is enormous, right?
Mm.
If the economy doubles in a period, then my investment should be doubling in that period. So if it takes a month to get somewhere, that's just a huge sacrifice of opportunities that I could have used the assets for some other way. So the faster the economy goes, the more it costs to suffer a time delay, especially travel time delay.
Mm. Is this why we've seen no grabby aliens? Is because every society's got emulation and then decided to stay?
So, I mean, in our future, as the Earth, you know, the world of M's will start out in a few dense cities, but, you know, if it keeps doubling every month, it won't be that long till the Earth gets filled up and then the solar system gets filled up and then you got to go somewhere else because it's full. So just in the long run, congestion will push our descendants to leave our solar system, if nothing else.
Mm. So they'll be forced to move out rather than one thing.
They want to keep growing, right?
Yeah,
so if you want to grow, if you want to expand and take new opportunities, you'll have to go where they are, and where they will be away from here when this is all filled.
Mm. And in talking about grabby aliens and the solar system and space, in general. Why have we not seen any aliens? Why? What are some of your predictions? You know, we could speak about the Great Filter, for example. What could be some future Great Filter events that we haven't got to yet that could be causing such emptiness and vastness and coldness?
We're running out of time, so I'll have to be very brief about this.
Keep it brief, yeah.
This is a big topic. The basic fact is, when we look out in the universe, we don't see much of anything that could be the sort of thing we hope to become. So there's a contradiction. We think it'll be pretty easy to get big and fill the solar system and then go to other stars. But we just look out. We don't see anything else like that happening. That is, we not only think we would go to the next few stars, we could think we could go to the next 1,000 stars, the next 1,000,000 stars.
Yeah.
And then we would not just visit them. We'd take them apart and change them and make big things happen. So our vision of our future involves big stuff happening that would be visible from a long way away. And then we look a long way away, we don't see any of that. So that's the puzzle. Why isn't there any of that going on out there? And plausibly, that's because the process that goes from simple dead matter to where we are now and where we hope to become soon is just a really hard process to go along the way. Most things who start down that path don't make it all the way. That's the filter, is whatever prevents things from going down that path. So the Great Filter must be large, because look around us, nothing we see is past the filter. So that's something I wrote about, you know, 25 years, a long time ago, about the Great Filter, 25 years ago, roughly. And then in the last 5 years, I went back to the topic to give a more numerical model of where are aliens in space-time. The answer is that, in fact, the Great Filter is still big, but now I can tell you exactly how big, and therefore answer some basic questions like, how far away is the nearest alien? How long it will be till we meet them? Things like that. And so the Grabby Aliens analysis, which you can see at grabbyaliens.com, works through taking three data points we have about the universe and using that to infer three key parameters about the aliens. And then that three parameter model gives us the distribution of aliens in space-time. And so basic answer is they're a long way away.
Yeah.
On average, once per 1,000,000 galaxies, say, is how far apart the aliens are. And on average, we might meet them in, say, 1 billion years. If we were to go out and go as fast as we can, and on average, they're spreading at a substantial fraction of the speed of light, which is why we can't see them. We won't see them till they're almost here.
Something to think about then. And as a last question, Robin, if you could give your 20-year-old self one piece of advice, what would it be and why?
I don't know if I have any useful advice for him, but I guess advice for him and the rest of you, I'm not sure he wasn't already following, is just, we live in a society where lives are long. You can do a lot in a lifetime of the sort of lifetimes we have. So, you know, go for the long game. You know, rather than, I mean, you should do stuff when you're 20. You should try stuff. You should learn stuff. But a lot of it is practice and exploration and search shopping for all the things you could do more later. And realize that you'll have a long time to do a lot. And it's more important to like say, well, what's more important to do? What are the big interesting things to do than to do something immediately? But of course, you should do something immediately. But it's less about maybe what you accomplish immediately than how you prepare yourself for what you could do later.
Very good advice. Robin Hanson, ladies and gentlemen. Robin, you are very, very smart, and I really appreciate your time. This was
awesome.
Well,
that's the point of academia here. I'm trying to impress you that the function is
exactly. Really love this. And going to have to leave aliens for a future discussion in the next few years, because I absolutely love that side of your work.
If you want to go more into it, definitely, we could talk more.
Awesome. And where can people go if they want to find your work?
Hanson.gmu.edu, or search for my name, Robin Hanson, on, say, Twitter or other web searches.
Awesome. I'll leave links to, you know, your TED Talks and everything in the description. Thanks so much for joining me.
Okay, take care.
Awesome. If you've made it this far, you're likely not just a listener. You're ready to be the host. You felt that sense of intimacy and connection with our guest today, and you would like to get the same on your own show and start your own dream show. But you're worried about landing dream guests and all the complications and the mess that is often spoken about when starting your own podcast from scratch. You think starting a podcast requires a huge budget and a whole team, right? That is absolute nonsense. My Pro Remote Podcast Blueprint is the ultimate key to skipping the outdated advice and building a high quality, high impact show, even for under $100. It provides the proven strategies and AI templates that I use this day that you will be able to use to reclaim your time and creative control. And this is a strictly limited opportunity. Don't dilly-dally because there's limited spaces. We've already got one student, Rob, who's joined. That means there's only a couple more spaces to get the Pro Remote Podcast Blueprint course half price. And you need to act very, very fast because this is a limited offer and you're very, very early. So if you want to get the early bird discount like Rob has and get the results by watching the course that goes through the exact step-by-step blueprint that I use to this day to create these episodes that you've just watched and get the success and become Europe's fastest growing under 21 podcaster, and also join live weekly calls with me and use the AI templates and email templates that I use every single day to get the results and just get all my secrets without getting any of the mistakes and failures that I've made, then top link in the description is for you. And if you're ready to launch your own show and get personalized one-to-one help from me and copy my blueprint, which no other podcaster has shared, then I'll see you there. I'm rooting for you. Goodbye. Hope you enjoyed the episode too.